Hi, this is Julie.
This is Liz.
This is Sheila.
This is Monica.
This is Leanne.
We are the Satellite Sisters.
You are listening to Satellite Sisters to Go.
You are listening to Satellite Sisters. It's the Tuesday show. I'm Leanne Dolan in Pasadena, California. My sister Julie Dolan is in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Julie, happy Bastille Day.
I know, Leanne. I know, Leanne. Happy Bastille Day to you, too.
Merci.
It's a big day. I started off with, I made an egregious error, Leanne. I started off with an English muffin. What was I thinking? Okay. And it served me right. It was the worst English muffin I've ever had. It was one of those product extensions. It's the cinnamon vanilla Thomas's English muffins.
I fell for those too.
It's horrid.
It's like eating soap, isn't it?
Ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what our sister Monica, one of the lab rats, calls the aftertaste from this horrible English muffin. I might just have to go buy myself a croissant to just cleanse the palate, Leanne. But happy Bastille Day to you.
Merci. Merci. All right. We really actually have quite a show. We have a crime report. We're going to talk about Ghosts at a Watchman. That's coming out today. Maybe you're reading it right now. Pluto, of course, a big, big day for our favorite planet or demi-planet Pluto. I read a fascinating story in Sports Illustrated about teen athletes and heroin addiction, which sounds like two things that don't go together, but shockingly they do. We have some book recommendations. And then, of course, we have Paul, Dark and Handsome.
Julie. So satisfyingly in this episode, just one to savor.
It really is. Yeah, it's definitely a multiple watch episode. That's what I'd say about this one. Mm-hmm. So, but first on Saturday, we announced a couple of dates over the weekend for our upcoming book tour for You're the Best, A Celebration of Friendship. And I wanted to explain a few things to people. We are going to be in Brooklyn, New York, Thursday, October 29th at a great bookstore space called Powerhouse. Very excited about that. It will be a bunch of the Satellite Sisters and a bunch of the next generation who have contributed to this book, our nieces, our daughters-in-law. They will be joining us in Brooklyn for a big kickoff event just after the book is published. And then we are having a weekend event in Pasadena on Sunday, November 8th. At noon at Vroman's bookstore, lots of room to accommodate people. That will be Liz, Sheila, and I currently. And so those are the two set events that we have. Here's just the truth, people. We were so happy to announce that. People were posting, are you coming to Orlando? Are you coming here? Are you coming there? Book touring is very expensive, and we honestly just don't have the budget to fly all over the country to appear in bookstores. It's not lack of desire, is it, Julie?
No,
it's
we
lack
go
of
anywhere,
fun.
Talk yeah. to anyone. We are happy and excited to share this book with everyone, but that reality sets in, Leanne.
Yeah, it is. So that's just the truth. The days of the million-dollar book tours are over for every author, and especially when you're five authors. So here's the thing, though. If you have an organization, if you have a company that flies in speakers, maybe you're on the organizing committee of a local book event where you are, and there's some portion or the travel is paid for, you know, that we can try to work with. Certainly not all five sisters. People have real work schedule issues and things like that. But, you know, we would come to you, but we can't pay to come to you. It's just the simple answer there. But if you work for somebody, if you have an organization, as I said, if you're on a committee and you want to bring us in, some of us, one of us, two of us, fantastic. Like, we'd be happy to work with that. But I cannot promise a 10-city tour. I liked when someone said, are you coming back to Cape Cod? And I think the short answer is no.
I would love to go back to
again,
Cape Cod.
Not like we didn't want to, but we were there for a family wedding. So five of us flying planes, trains, automobiles, ferries to Cape Cod. That is unlikely. So if you wanted to be sure to catch us on the road, Brooklyn and Pasadena are the two big events. Other events, should they come up and are open to the public, we will let you know about. But I just wanted to make that clear. But put it out there. We're open to suggestions, and we're open to your ideas. We will be doing Skype book clubs when that becomes appropriate. We'll let you know about that. But that's just the reality. So, and I know a couple of people had posted, like, hey, this bookstore, invite the Satellite Sisters. Here's another. Bookstores don't have any money either. So... That's just, they don't pay for authors to show up. So that's just the truth. But that's why we're going to really try to do some special things in Brooklyn and in Pasadena. If you're thinking about maybe coming to Pasadena, considering it, I'm actually working with a local hotel this week to try to work out a special room rate. And maybe we'll have a special event the Saturday night before the Sunday book signing. So I just want to put that bee in your bonnet. I'm not a travel agent, but I am. So I just wanted, I'm working on that. So if you think maybe you and your satellite sister would enjoy a weekend in Southern California, or you're driving, we're going to work on this week on some special room rates, and we'll have all that information. But
well, good work, Leon, and thanks for setting us straight. Same is true in Brooklyn. Urban Nana had really, I've sung the praises of Brooklyn, and many people come to New York and never see Brooklyn. Plan a nice weekend, and that way you can come visit the Satellite Sisters at the Powerhouse, which I think is going to be super fun.
Yeah, so that's a Thursday night, and then Pasadena event is a Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. So that's just the reality. It pains me when I read things like, come to here, and I'm like, we would love to come there. So there's just some realities that we are facing, but that doesn't mean it's impossible. So our email, the best way to reach us, if you have an organization or and you have interest, we have a speakers page on our website at satellitesisters.com with the information we'll need. And that email is info@satellitesisters.com. But first go to the speakers page and read about, the information we'll need before we can commit to anything. And then send us an email at info@satellitesisters.com. All right. Julie, though, you had a big birthday.
Did
you make that kale cake that was on the Facebook page?
That was so thoughtful, thoughtful, knowing of my great love of kale, to have a nice green birthday cake. No, I did not. Lee and I had a delicious strawberry rhubarb pie with 19 candles in the pie, which is quite a lot for a piece of pie, for a pie. And that was very successful. I absolutely loved all the comments, the wishes that people posted at Facebook. Thank you so much. I mean, it's a little thing, but it makes it for a very exciting day to see all those messages.
It's true.
I love it. I love it. So that was good. The big plan, of course, was to go floating in an inner tube down the Yampa River here in Steamboat. And we had Camp Nana's going on here, and we had the 6 and the 8-year-old were totally psyched. We had our float clothes on, we have shoes and t-shirts. We headed down to the river, and there was a giant sign, Leon, at the inner tube rental. You had to be 10 and up to float down the river.
That makes sense.
It's only because the river is high and fast right now. But it was
devastating.
It was devastating to an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old to see 10 and up. You remember those days when you were not tall enough to get on an amusement ride? Yeah. So we consoled ourselves with putt-putt golf, Lee, and we had a fabulous birthday. So that was it. But the river is going to go down, Leon. That's the lesson. That's the big nature lesson at Nana Camp. The river does, it rises and it falls. And there will be a float day coming up.
And no follow-up questions.
Right. Don't ask me about the cubic feet. Don't ask me about that.
Okay. All right. Well, I had this weekend, I had some college friends in. This is the year when many people are turning 50 that I know, who I graduated from college with. And so I was sort of I'm like an adjunct friend to this group of college friends. And
what does that mean, Leon?
That they had their own group, but that I was friends with a couple of them individually. And I went to a small school. There were only 300 people in my class at Pomona. So you really knew everybody anyway. So I was happy to be included in some of their activities. This was a group primarily of swimmers and soccer players. And I, as a lacrosse player, I was happy to be invited. And as someone with broad shoulders, I love hanging out with swimmers. They just...
You and the Butterflyers, that's
yes.
it?
I mean, some of these women still, only this year were their records broken at the collegiate level. These were national record holders, this particular group of swimmers. We actually had a very good Division III swim team at Pomona. So I was happy to be included in this. And so we had, Julie, I was thinking of, you wrote a great piece for our book. You're the best. It's about, excuse me, it's about the girls' weekends that you've been doing for so many years, and you did a guide, and you'll see that when it comes out in October. Some really sort of unexpected great suggestions about how to have a girls' weekend. But one of your number one rules is no restaurants. Like, just don't go to restaurants because it becomes too complicated and everyone's too opinionated. And so I took that to heart. There was a subset of this group in Thursday night, and I said, they said, let's go out to dinner. I said, just come to my house. I got the meal. I got the salmon. I got the chickpea salad. I got the cucumber salad now that's in regular rotation at my house. Julia even had a hot hors d'oeuvre. I had a hot hors d'oeuvre. Yes, on you.
I'm telling you, when you go to Leanne Dolan's house on a weeknight, it's you get a hot meal, multiple sides, and so special occasions, a hot hors d'oeuvre. Leanne, what'd you serve?
I served, well, it was it was from Trader Joe's. I never buy their pre-made stuff usually, but it was like a Greek feta spanakopita thing. It was like a cheesy hot Greek thing. It was good, right? Because here's the other lesson I learned this weekend: women love cheese, because then. Then my friend showed up and they had brought stuff for a cheese plate. And they said, well, you can serve it for dessert. And I was like, well, how continental is that? So we had cheese as a first course and then cheese as dessert.
You girls, you're so European. That's very nice.
And then the next night, Kristen, who was hosting everybody at their house, nothing fancy. They were all just like sleeping on the floor and air mattresses at Kristen's house, which is near mine. Her boyfriend had put together like a surprise wine tasting. So it was official wine tasting with the sommelier. And then another giant cheese platter, like the biggest cheese platter I have ever seen. I mean,
so what is this? This is the secret thing that women, when they sneak away together, it's not to go to spas. It's just to eat cheese. We deprive ourselves of cheese year round. But when we get together, it's a cheese fest. Is that right?
It must be. I mean, I've never seen so much cheese in like a 48-hour period.
Is it that you're drinking so much wine, you need the cheese to cut the wine?
No, it wasn't even that. You know, okay. I mean, it's the wine tasting, you're only getting a bit. I mean, this was just an extraordinary cheese platter and full of cheeses that I'm never brave enough to buy, you know, like Saint Andre and things like that. I don't know how to serve that kind of cheese.
Very nice for Bastille Day to have a little French pronunciation in there, Leanne.
Thank you.
Salon.
But it was really fun. And then after the wine tasting and the cheese, then we did, I think, what people do now. We all got on Facebook and looked up ex-boyfriends. So that was fun too.
Cute.
That's what our generation does.
Really?
Pretty much your friends of friends, you can find them. Oh, they're out there. You know, now we're all connected. Like, oh, let's see what he's up to these days. So that was pretty funny.
Now, did you take the next step and actually contact the ex-boyfriends? You showed restraint.
Okay.
Woo,
no one in this group was available. Let's just put it that way. No one in this group was available for that. So, it was really fun. It was excellent. So I don't know, maybe in the version 2 of our book, just add more cheese to the girls' weekend.
That was not one of my helpful suggestions, Leanne, but I think it's a word of wisdom for that everyone, as they're planning their women's weekends, there are a lot that happen in the fall, you know, just pile on the cheese.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's a meal. All right. The really big news of the day today is this Pluto flyby. Okay. I don't know if you've been following along, Julie, but
only because you talk about Pluto, and because now Pluto moons is part of my, you know, I have added it to my daily expressions, Leanne, you know, that there's definitely a Pluto moon situation most days, right?
Fundamentally unstable. That's what it means. So, okay, here's the deal. 9 years ago, this team of scientists sent this probe out into the world, New Horizon, which I have to say is a bad name. But other than that, it's...
Hey, it's Liz and Leanne here, and we want to thank PROS for supporting this episode of Satellite Sisters. Now, you know, Liz, I've been out and about with my new book, The Marriage Sabbatical. The book is getting rave reviews. I'm very happy. But you know what else is getting rave reviews? My hair, Liz. My hair from PROS is getting rave reviews.
Leanne, I am not surprised. You have been on that PROS hair regimen for quite a while. I mean, you have good hair anyway, but now you have great hair because you've really paid attention to it.
Well, Liz, Prose is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. And you know what? I love the regimen they have me on. Do I take the hair vitamins every day? Yes, I do. Do I use my shampoo and conditioner made especially for Lee and Dolan? Yes, I do. I sometimes use the leave-in conditioner when my hair's really dry? I do. And I even have a pre-scalp thing that they give me. Okay, Pros, you're the boss. I'll take it. You tell me what my hair needs. That sounds good. And here's the thing. It's personalization, Liz. For millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely Lian's, okay? And I'm using it. Prose isn't just better for you. It's also better for the planet, Liz. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. So, Prose, we love you. I love the photos of my hair. Couldn't be happier.
Photos of your hair. There are people in the photos, too. That's the thing about a book tour. Everybody has their picture taken with Lian and then post it. So the hair is important.
Couldn't be happier, Prose. Prose is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin. They're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/sisters. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at prose.com/sisters. And Prose is spelled P-R-O-S-E, prose.com/sisters. Thanks, Prose. Liz, you know we love talking about Framebridge, don't we?
We do. because there are just so many fun things to frame, Lian, aren't there?
Right. Anything. You can just upload a digital photo from your phone and they can print it and frame it. And that is a gift right there, a gift people would love getting. But Liz, you recently had quite an exciting Framebridge experience. Would you like to share?
I talked about how when we were at the Bruce Springsteen concert, I was with our brother Dick, his wife Susan, his two kids, and one of the roadies threw us the set list at the end of the show, which was amazing. To get the actual set list for the actual concert in Los Angeles. And we're like, oh, yeah, any day now, that's going to be in a place of honor in their home. Sure enough, Lian, they have already Framebridged it and sent it to us with a picture. So I'll be in Bend next week, so I'll get to see it. But it's just excellent use of the Framebridge resources, the Bruce Springsteen set list.
Fantastic. And this is gift giving season. So if you have a graduation coming up, a wedding, a shower, Mother's Day, Father's Day, look around. I'm sure you have something fun you can frame, and Framebridge can do it for you. It's easy and it's affordable to frame just about anything. You get fair and transparent upfront pricing based on the size of your item. There's a great selection of frames. And as we've said in the past, fast service, free shipping, great for gifts. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Liz, not many things in life give you a happiness guarantee, but Framebridge does. If you're not 100% happy with your piece, they will make it right. So if this
but
sounds like...
But you're going to be happy, okay? Yeah. That's just the Satellite Sisters promise. You're going to be out. You're going to be happy you did it.
See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit framebridge.com or see a local Framebridge store to get started and custom frame just about anything, like a Bruce Springsteen set list. That's framebridge.com. Thanks, Framebridge.
They didn't talk to Liz about branding. Okay. No, that they could have come up with. Did you have something snappier?
Yeah, that sounds like a rehab facility to me. But other than that, I mean, I understand it's like mapping the entire universe or galaxy or whatever. Yeah. Fine. But New Horizon, just it's too vague. But so I would have gone with like Pluto Palooza or something. But they launched this probe in 2006, and it's the fastest man-made object ever. It goes 30,000 miles per hour.
Okay, just to think about that is a pretty amazing thing, Lian.
It goes a million miles a day. A million miles a day. Okay.
That's insane. I feel that way at Camp Nana. I am going close to a million miles a day. But I can't keep up with the New Horizon.
And 9 years later, it has traveled its 3 billion miles to get to Pluto, the dwarf planet, who many people love. I'm not the only Plutophile. There are many of us out there. There's something very sweet about Pluto. And it's, I think, in no small part due to the Walt Disney dog. But this probe has done this complete recon of the solar system. It's about as big as a grand piano. And this morning at about 4 a.m. my time, 7 a.m. Eastern, it flew as close as it was going to get to Pluto. Uh-huh. And it's going to make a two 2-hour loop around Pluto, just data, 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 taking photos and absorbing data. And it's going to give us the first and best look ever at, you know, what Pluto is really made of. But here's the exciting part. Then it starts to beam back the information. And I don't know if beam is actually the technical term.
Leanne, you are our space sister. So if you say beam, that's fine. I know that one time we interviewed Sally Ride and you asked her about going up in her rocket ship.
It's, yes, I did.
One of my favorite Satellite Sister moments. So if you call it beam, that's fine with me.
Okay. Thank you, Jill. All right. So it takes it's the data is traveling at the speed of light, but it still takes about 4.5 hours to get to the Earth. So it's about 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern time that they're going to have a phone home with New Horizon. That's what they call it. New Horizon phones home. It's like the guys at Johns Hopkins pick up the phone and go, oh, it's Pluto calling, you know, and then all the data starts coming in. And then the data is just going to keep coming. The first photos will be out tomorrow morning, according to the NASA website and according to Satellite Sisters listener, Leslie Maxfield, who actually works at Caltech and knows a lot about this stuff. She's on it for us. But it's incredible. Like the guy who's been running this project, Alan Stern, the project manager, 26 years he's been working on this. I mean, literally his whole career. So imagine how excited he was this morning when it flew by, closest it was ever going to get. And when it connects, when Pluto phones home, it's going to be fantastic, isn't it?
Well, I hope it all works. I mean, you know, it must be just the anxiety level that, like, you know, are the pictures really going to come through? Are we really going to see any of this data? That's amazing. So I'm sure the anticipation is very high. I know it is here at Satellite Sisters. Right?
Well,
I'm excited, Leanne. You've turned me on to Pluto.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I know it's the maverick planet. We all felt really badly when it got demoted. But I think we're part of the believers that Pluto, you know, is really important. And they do believe, I mean, that it's going to provide just valuable information about the solar system and about what we're doing here on Earth too. I mean, that's, I think, the big part. I mean, I saw an editorial that said, you know, that maybe we'll learn how we won't go extinct if we can use, which would be a good thing.
It's
right?
A good thing.
I'm the oldest sister, so I don't really have to worry about it, but you might, Leanne.
And I also want to alert people tonight on the National Geographic Channel, check your local listings, but they have been running a series about this Pluto New Horizons mission. So they're going to introduce you to the whole team and everything tonight. So if you want to see behind the scenes stuff, check out the National Geographic Channel tonight. That is on. But it's exciting to me. And, you know, when these people work on it for so long, Fast Company actually had a good article on the Pluto team about how do you actually design a mission that is so far out in the future, and how do you people work on it for a few years and then move on to other research, but you need to keep connected. And I'll just post that at satellitesisters.com, because for any business, when you're like looking at your 5-year plan, your 10-year plan, your 20-year plan, there's something to learn about this. They produce what's called a longevity document.
Ooh.
And then
we have one of those at Satellite Sisters.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Julie. Wait, what? then they figured out the contingency plan, and they actually listed like 249 things that could go wrong. And here are the solutions to that. And then they just had a simple, we don't even have this. They just kept a simple contact list, Julie.
I know. If I asked you right now, do you know my home address?
Is a reason you didn't get a birthday card. I don't know what the home address is in Steamboat. And neither does Liz. And honestly, I don't know Liz's home address either.
So we could start there, Leanne. You know, a journey. It's one small step. That's the start.
Okay. All right. Get a contact list. All right. Okay. There you go.
All right. Well, that is exciting, Leanne. I mean, I think the Pluto news actually eclipses the other big news that came out this week, which of course is the publication of Harper Lee's new old book called Go Set a Watchman, right? I mean, this is really sort of literary history that this book is coming out. Now, we've been talking about it since February.
Yes.
Remember, we mentioned this, and it has just come out. I think today is the public date, and maybe you've seen some of the early reviews of the book. Then this is, I guess you'd call it, it's the first draft of To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, the story of To Kill a Mockingbird is Harper Lee brought Go Set a Watchman, or most of Go Set a Watchman, to an editor. And the editor said, you know, it might be better to tell the story from, 20 years earlier, from when Scout is a young girl rather than as a grown woman. And so Harper Lee went back and rewrote what is, you know, an American classic. It is a beloved book. It was a terrific movie. But then this manuscript has appeared, and that goes back, and I want to talk about the discovery of the manuscript. But the reviews of this book, Leon, have you read any online yet? Or
I did. I read the New York Times, and then I heard George Stephanopoulos read a copy, so he gave like a thumbnail review of it, and he said it was a very compelling. He said he found the father-daughter relationship between Atticus and Scout, although she now goes by her grown-up name in the book, very compelling. He said, okay, it was a very readable book. That's what he said.
But other people have written that it's really a very, you know, it's very dark. That
yes,
it is the story of Scout comes back to, she returns to Macomb from New York to really realize that her father is a racist and that her boyfriend is a racist and that, you know, it's very distressing to see the evil views of her parents. I mean, and you know, so much of To Kill a Mockingbird is about the loss of innocence. And when I read these reviews, I felt the same way about Go Set a Watchman. It is sort of a loss of innocence about a beloved book and a wonderful movie starring Gregory Peck. That yeah. I mean, that movie is wonderful.
It is. It's fantastic. No, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
And,
it is.
And, you know, it is. And it's in some ways it's very shocking. I mean, I don't know what I expected this new manuscript to be about, or that it would, you know, portray Atticus, the lead character, in such a different fashion. But you know, in To Kill a Mockingbird, I mean, he is the one that is humble, is noble. He's, you know, he's fighting for the rights of a black man. You know, and in this second book, Go Set a Watchman, you know, it's sort of turned upside down. I mean, it's really the portrait of Atticus Finch is really upended. And I think that, you know, I think it.
Well, it's upsetting to a lot of people. I mean,
yes,
you know,
yes,
he's a great literary hero. So
yes,
for many, many people, he's their favorite character in all of literature. You know, it's a book that's read in almost every single public school and private school in this country. Oh, it's, you know, one of the few books we really have as a nation that almost everyone reads as they grow up. So you can't avoid reading it. And so
you wouldn't want to avoid
right,
reading
no,
it.
Right. No, I just.
Mean, that's,
right. So
that's why this
upsetting.
Is so upsetting. And so, but the backstory of how this manuscript came to be, yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article, an editorial by the literary agent, Tanya Carter, who is responsible for finding the manuscript. And the headline, Leon, is, my interpretation is, it's still very suspicious how Tanya Carter came to, who is the trustee of the estate of Harper Lee. And Harper Lee is 89, Leon.
Yeah.
So, but how this manuscript came to be found and then how it came to be published. And she was trying, Tanya Carter, the attorney, was trying to set the record straight about how she alone was able to go into this safe deposit box and find this manuscript. In the same safe deposit box that, like, in 2011, Sam Pincus, who was the literary agent for Harper Lee, and Mr. Caldwell, who was an appraiser, because they were trying to examine and appraise the original manuscript of To Kill a Mockingbird, and how in this one safe deposit box, these two men who spent over an hour examining all the documents in there sort of failed to see this other manuscript, Go Set a Watchman. And then lo and behold, Tanya Carter, the attorney, you know, 3 years later, hears from the family members that there is a second novel, and she just goes back to the safe deposit box and, oh, guess what? She finds the manuscript, Leon.
Whole thing is very suspicious. So, the worst part. I mean, that's why I'm torn about whether to read the book or not. I just don't feel right about reading this book.
I would say I'm not there yet. I can understand and appreciate sort of the historic significance of this.
Yeah.
But all the circumstances, and even the fact that Miss Carter did not use Sam Pincus, the literary agent. She went and used Miss Lee's foreign markets agent to bring this book out. So I have a lot of questions about, was this really what Miss Harper Lee wanted? Where was this manuscript? How is it possible that, you know, a literary agent and, you know, a literary appraiser somehow missed, you know, this document in a safe deposit box? How big could that safe deposit box be, Leon? You know?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer and an author, I'm happy that people are pouring into bookstores to buy books, okay? And that the whole nation is talking about a book. On the other hand, you know, here's what happens. I don't remember things I wrote in my first novel. Like, my guess is if Harper Lee claims she, you know, her friends say she really wanted it to come out, she probably doesn't recall that manuscript at all. It's 60 years old. Mm-hmm. And you can't, especially if it was like a first or second draft. And the New York Times yesterday had a good piece about her original editor and how important he was in shaping To Kill a Mockingbird and taking the elements of that manuscript, Watchmen, and making it into Mockingbird. So when you are a novelist and you write draft after draft after draft, you can't remember what's in stuff. And then she never wrote another book, so that's not really her issue in terms of forgetting and moving on to the next story. But when people ask me about questions about what's in Helena Pasadena, I forget that I wrote it. Like, I forget the details. So I imagine an 89-year-old Harper Lee going, I have another book? I mean, let's bring it out.
I would like to know how, you know, Harper Lee is benefiting from this. Right. I hope she is, and, you know, and her family, but how this trustee is benefiting from it and why.
Well, mainly the publishers, I believe, are benefiting. Yeah. Yeah. I think ultimately her legacy, the book is being well enough received in terms of the reviews and stuff that I don't think her legacy as a writer will be trashed. But Atticus Finch's legacy as a character, maybe, which is unfortunate. But I was worried before the book came out that it was just going to be awful. You know,
many of the reviews say that there are some very lovely passages in there, and that, you know, that the sort of lyrical style that you saw in To Kill a Mockingbird is definitely present in this book. It's interesting, here in Steamboat Springs, they have a tradition of picking a book for the community. And they pick one book and they ask everyone in the community to read it. They have already gone ahead to pick Go Set a Watchman as their community book for this coming year, I'm sure it will lead to many discussions like this, Leon.
Right.
I'm with you. I'm not like running out to the bookstore or running out to Amazon to order a copy of this.
And remember, it was her sister that was her lawyer and agent for 60 years and kept that book under wraps. And really, whose main job seemed to be protecting her legacy. So it is, the whole circumstance is very, very suspicious. And someone stands to make a... And again, I would also say, my guess is that, you know, Harper Lee makes probably still a lot of money from To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, it's every single American school kid reads that book. So it's not like she was doing it for the money. So I'm going to reserve judgment. I may or may not read it. I'm not going to rush to the bookstore to read it. And I'll see, only because I feel like something about this is still fishy. Still fishy. Mm-hmm. Still fishy, mm-hmm. Joel.
Okay, Leanne. I'm with you on that one.
But I do have a couple of books that I have been reading. You know, I'm trying desperately. Well, I'm doing all these author interviews, which is fun.
Which are great people.
Thank you.
Please listen to Leanne's. You're very good at this, Leanne.
Thank you. Well, every writer has a different process, and that's what's fascinating. Like, there's not just one way to write a book. And I get asked these questions all the time about my process. So it's fun to ask other writers that, but it's also really interesting for me to hear about how they put stuff together. And all the books we've read are very different. So two books I happened to read over the last week, that I wanted to recommend. They're almost on the opposite ends of women's fiction. The first one, Julie, is just for you. You're probably exhausted at night, so you don't need any help getting to sleep. But there's a very cute book out called The Royal We. Have you heard about this book?
No, Lee, and I haven't. Tell me.
What's clever about it is that it's a reimagining of the Kate and William story. But imagine if Kate was an American girl. So it's a super clever concept, and it's co-written by two women. I'm usually not a big fan of the whole co-writing thing, but these are the women.
What are you talking about? We're doing a book together, Liam.
No, that's true. Never mind. Novels.
This is our second book together. You're not a fan of this?
Novels.
Just telling us now?
Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of this. I'm protesting our own book. So about these two women have written a bunch of books together. They also started the website. I want to make sure I say it correctly. Fugly, that website.
Take your time with that word.
Yes. Really. Yeah. So, Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan, but it's kind of a YA. It fits in that or young adults, a young contemporary adult category. But if you enjoy the royals and if you think it would be fun to read about this kind of fictitious royal family, but based very much on the current royal family in that situation. And then you throw in the fact that, the girlfriend is an American from the Midwest, whose father made their fortune creating what is called the Couchurator. It's a couch with a refrigerator in it. So it's funny. So that was delightful. I think Jenny actually from our Facebook page recommended that, and I saw that. So I picked it up on my Kindle and I ripped through it, and it was fun. Now, on the other end of the women's fiction spectrum is Dietland, a book by Sari Walker.
Sounds horrible, but go ahead.
Well, it's kind of, it takes the idea of sort of a, feel good story about a girl who's been overweight her whole life and is trying to change her life, and completely flips it on its ear and makes it sort of a feminist revenge story. So,
okay.
So I would say.
Now I'm in, Leanne.
Yeah. I think, if you took some women's studies classes in college and have sort of fallen off the bandwagon of your outrage and you want to get back on in terms of exploitation of women in the media and body shaming and things like that, this is the novel for you, because it has a lot of sort of familiar tropes from normal women's fiction. But in the middle of it, like, it takes a right-hand turn and all of a sudden it's like feminist terrorists out there taking revenge on people who exploit women. So I will say this. The language is rough in that book. Okay. So it has, like a cupcake on the cover with an explosive cupcake on the cover. But it is adult language in that book. And I know some people who listen to Satellite Sisters do not read books with adult language or adult themes. And it definitely does that. But, if you and your college age daughter want to read this together and talk about it, I think that would also be a good summer reading project. But I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. I found the story very compelling and the main character very compelling. And just, there aren't a lot of times when you read women's fiction, you think, well, there's some good themes in there. Like, it's a controversial book to read for your book club. If you're looking for a pick and you have a book club, that's kind of game to get into something juicy and in discussion. So that's Dietland by Sari Walker. And I will put both of those on the website. And if you're looking for book recommendations we talk about, please go to satellitesisters.com. When we do shows, we do the show notes, and we usually do post, if we talked about a book, we'll post a link to that book. And then you can always use the search feature. We usually tag it books or book recommendations. So there you go. So two books for you.
That's really the yin and yang of reading.
It really is. It is.
Do you recommend reading those two together?
No, whatever.
The coupling of those two?
I read Dietland, and then I had The Royal We on my Kindle. It was kind of a palate cleanser. Now I'm reading a couple of books that will come out in 6 months, some advanced reading, or 6 weeks. I'm reading some ARCs. So, yeah, I thought it was just, you know, whatever you want to do. They're not related in any way. I just happened to read two books that were very much the opposite. So there you go.
Okay. Leon, I know you wanted to talk about an article you read a couple of weeks ago.
We're going to that. All right. I want to mention this because I know that we have a lot of people in the audience who are sports moms and dads. And so I saw this headline in Sports Illustrated on the front page of the magazine that said high school athletes and heroin addiction. And I was like, what? Yeah, I had that same feeling, Julie. I was like, you know, the startling connection between high school athletes and heroin addiction. And so this is a Sports Illustrated special report by John Wertheim and Ken Rodriguez. They spent 7 months researching the connection between athletes and heroin. And here's what happens, Julian. When they lay it out in the article, it's pretty obvious to see how it happens. You know, most people become addicted to heroin because they start on prescription pain medication. Right. That is for 80% of people who end up using heroin. They started with, you know, prescribed medicine, like an oxycodone. Mm-hmm. And what happens in sports? What happens to high school athletes? They get injured. There's pressure to get back on the field quickly. You know, in some sports like football and hockey and lacrosse, there's kind of a play with pain mentality that, you know, is supported by coaches and parents and school administrators. So these high school kids are getting incredibly powerful drugs. They're going back onto the field maybe too soon. They're being encouraged to play with pain. The stakes seem very high for them. And for some of these athletes, they begin to spiral into, you know, prescription pain medication addiction. But that's very expensive. So then they're looking for the same sort of high, but much cheaper. So it's $30, for instance, to buy, you know, an oxycodone hit on the street, but it's $5 for heroin. So these, I know.
Really? That's the pricing.
That's the pricing. Okay. Yeah. So it's kind of shocking, but it sort of makes sense. Now, it's hard to find actual numbers for how many, you know, how many high school athletes this affects, but they are definitely seeing hot spots because kids are dying from heroin addiction. Yeah. And we've seen plenty of reports in the paper that heroin addiction is way up, that death rates for heroin addiction are way up, like it's back with a vengeance. And, you know, the study, they're looking at a 2013 national study, 11% of high school kids will use Oxy or Vicodin for non-medical purposes when they're in high school. And then it just becomes, it kind of spirals out of control. Athletes are 2 times a greater odds of being prescribed these kind of painkillers and 4 times a greater odds of medically misusing these painkillers compared to males who don't participate in competitive sports. So I just wanted to alert parents. We'll put a link on the website to this article because there's one case. I mean, they profile super sad cases of great high school, baseball players. You know, obviously, once they start taking heroin, they're no longer in competition for, you know, a baseball scholarship. Right. But just how quickly that road goes down. They were the star athletes their senior year, and by 22, they're dead of a heroin addiction. And it's just, you know, the opiate addiction, I believe, is the hardest addiction to kick. And what's extraordinary when you read the article is how many times the athletes say, you know, we were, you know, tweaked a knee or tweaked a shoulder, and the doctor will hand him a prescription for Oxy and say, oh, this is the good stuff. It's like it's a joke. Yeah. And there just doesn't seem to be any awareness on the part of the medical community or coaches or, you know, athletic administrators, like how quickly this can spin out of control. So I just wanted.
I'm glad you're mentioning it because is it just the high stakes of high school, you know, sports? You know, everybody wants to get a scholarship. There's so much, you know, parent pressure and involvement that maybe they do know this can spiral out of control, but they, you know, they ignore the dangers of prescription drugs.
I think it's all part of it. And, you know, and they make the point in the article, it cuts across, you know, all socioeconomic classes. You have, you know, the wealthy lacrosse players from Connecticut are just as likely to be addicted as, you know, the poor baseball players from some scrub town in Arizona. Like they profile, you know, three or four athletes that unfortunately died from heroin addiction. And it cuts across all kinds of parenting, all kinds of socioeconomic realms. Yeah. So I just thought it was interesting. It's, you know, I was thinking back on my son's high school career. He wasn't ever prescribed that. He had injuries, but nothing that required a Vicodin. But I know when I got that Vicodin for the dental stuff I had, I would take a half maybe and then just throw it away. I mean, you don't even want it in the house.
Right.
You don't want that stuff in the house.
You shouldn't have it in the house, Land. Yeah,
no.
Be afraid.
So it's just a cautionary tale. I think it's something for all parents who have kids involved in sports to be aware of. And so I'll put a link at satellitesisters.com to that article.
Thank you, Land. Okay. And that's why it's probably so maddening, distressing, disturbing that Joaquin El Chapo Guzman... the bad guy, billionaire, narco trafficker. Guess what? He's taunting all the former captors, you know, everyone both on the Mexican side and the U.S. side. By he posted a picture of himself in the cockpit of a plane enjoying a beer. So, you know, he is the bad guy billionaire that escaped from the Mexican prison, you know, but the social media aspect of this, you know, escape is what to me is so fascinating. So it's not enough that he got out, Leon, that he, you know, that he spent all that money to get out. It's that he now feels like he wants to stick it to his captors and he wants to announce to the world that he's back by posting a picture that he's in the, you know, drinking beer and enjoying himself and back with his beauty queen wife. I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, even before he escaped, there were a number of sort of heads up that something was going on. The U.S. had heard, you know, through back channels that they thought an escape was in the works. But then Guzman's son put out on Twitter, Leon, that he had the tweet, "The general will soon be back." Can you believe that? Before he actually escaped. And of course, it's a spectacular escape. If, you know, with his narco trafficking money, he built a mile long tunnel. He had a motorcycle on rails with lighting and ventilation to, you know, to build this tunnel so that he could escape. And there's apparently a very popular post in Mexico that is a picture of a thick wad of dollar bills all rolled up, with the caption, "The tunnel through which El Chapo escaped." How about that? I mean, his capture, the fact that he was imprisoned was what the president of Mexico based his whole, you know, he based everything in his government on, that we are going to address, you know, the seriousness of, you know, of the drug trafficking, that we are not going to be susceptible to corruption. And I'm sure there were threats within the prison to make the guards look the other way. But it's not unlike the prison escape in Clinton, New York, where you just know that people must have known this was going on. You know, it's not like you can build that kind of tunnel, you know, have that kind of escape without other, you know, people being involved.
Isn't there a detail too that he could actually stand up in the tunnel? Like how big it was?
Because he's 5'9".
He was a luxuriously large. Yes, he wasn't crawling on that tunnel. Yeah.
Liz and Leanne here, and we are so grateful to have Osea support Satellite Sisters. Why? Because it's just a great product. Holy cow, we love Osea's skin and body care. And you know what? This Mother's Day, just look no further than Osea. Spoil the moms in your life with the little luxuries from Osea. The moms, the stepmoms, the bonus moms, the people who bring a touch of something special to your life, aunts, grandmothers, they would love a little Osea this Mother's Day. And you can get 10% off your first order by using our code SATSISTERS at OseaMalibu.com. And Liz, you know what every mother and mother figure needs?
What?
More moisture, Liz. They need more moisture in their skin.
in no their kidding. Skin. I mean, really, the creams, the lotions, the oils, I love it all. That duo they have going, like, you can't miss with the duo of Osea.
Liz, the Mega Moisture Duo. Yes. You can literally see your skin get firmer, and it just delivers this full body glow. Okay, you know we have raved about the Undaria Algae Body Oil. Mm-hmm. Well, pair that with the Undaria Collagen Body Oil. Youthful, Liz, your youthful glow is going to happen. And it's infused with Osea's signature Undaria seaweed. So it just smells so delicious, doesn't it?
I know you're talking about giving it as a gift. I also suggest just giving it to yourself because you're worth it.
That's true. That is absolutely true. Okay, that moisture duo I mentioned too is a great value because you can save 16% plus the extra 10% with our code SAD Sisters. So this is it. This is a win-win-win Mother's Day gift. Spoil the moms in your life with clean vegan skincare and body care from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with the code SAD Sisters at OseaMalibu.com. And you get free samples in every order and free shipping on orders over $60. Osea is spelled O-S-E-A. So head on over to OseaMalibu.com and use code SATSISTERS for 10% off. Thanks, Osea. Liz, summer is coming up, and you know what that means? It means you're grilling. You're grilling and chilling there with your butcher box. What do you got going on the grill this summer?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Because I'm going to be up in Bend for part of the summer, yeah, I'm having my box sent there, Leanne.
That's great.
Go on vacation with your butcher box is what I'm recommending. Yeah, either way, you're just going to buy meat and fish and stuff when you get there. Why do that? Anyway, I love their steaks. I love their scallops. The scallops are really good. And the chicken thighs, all good. I'm ready.
That's right. Butcher Box gives you peace of mind and easy to find high quality meat and seafood you can trust. It's 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork that's raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. No antibiotics or added hormones. And as Liz said, delivered right to your doorstep. And you can customize that delivery plan, Liz, right? Because it can go wherever you want it to go, whenever you want it to go. If you want to delay it a week, you know, speed it up a week, you just go to your Butcher Box account and you can make that all happen.
It's so easy to manage online.
Yeah. And if you're like Liz, you can take your Butcher Box on vacation, which is... That's nice. Nice to have something familiar there.
Yes.
So if you want to take your meat on vacation, sign up at butcherbox.com/sisters and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. So you can choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/sisters and use code SISTERS to choose your free for a year offer, plus get $20 off your first order. Thanks, ButcherBox.
Ventilation and lighting. He's El Chapo, Leon. He wanted to walk his way or ride the little motorcycle thing to freedom. And there are reports that once he made it through the tunnel, the mile-long tunnel, there was a helicopter waiting to take him away. Yeah. But the fact that he's taunting the authorities is so maddening. So, you know.
Keep your eye out for him, Julie. keep monitoring the situation.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think for all prisons, you should be checking for tunnels, don't you think, Leanne?
I think you should.
I mean, it really wasn't that complicated of a plan. I mean, even though he had lighting and ventilation, it's the basic tunneling out of prison.
Right. It seems to be the only plan they got, you know, other than going out with the laundry. That's the other one, too. Right. They got the tunnel or the laundry.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's not funny, but it's just hard to relate. So this is just clearly a guy with so much money and so much power and is so corrupt. And so, you know, people will roll over and do whatever he wants them to do. So
because that, you know, because he threatens them as well. I mean, it's not I mean, some of it is corruption, but some of it is life threatening. And that, you know, I mean, he is a bad guy and I hope they can get him back. But I don't know where they're going to put him. So that was my first crime report that I saw this morning. And then the other one that is. I'm puzzled by it, Leanne. There was a headline today regarding this case, a California case. This was of a couple, Denise Hoskins and her boyfriend, Aaron Quinn. And they claim that intruders broke into their house and tied up Aaron, the boyfriend, and took Denise Hoskins, and that this was a kidnapping, and they required a ransom of $8,500. And then, you know, sort of as a surprise, Denise shows up 3 days later in Huntington Beach. But the part that is, that it gets more curious is the Vallejo Police Department that were investigating this kidnapping didn't really believe it actually went on. They're calling it kind of the Gone Girl hoax, that there was, according to the police, there was no evidence to support the claim that a kidnapping actually occurred. Okay. And so these people were discredited. They were humiliated. You know, they were sort of vilified because, you know, they sort of made up this wild story. Well, this morning, the FBI are involved and they have announced that they have an arrest warrant out for someone that they believe is doing this, is like breaking into houses, kidnapping, you know, tying people up, kidnapping them. And so now all of us, Denise Hoskins and Aaron Quinn appeared with their attorneys to say, you know, hey, now you should believe me, that, you know, you should believe us that this actually did happen. And so there may be
a weird story.
It is, Lynn. It's, you know, it's.
I really kind of saw the headlines, but I was cleaning the kitchen this morning. I wasn't paying any attention. I didn't know this is what this was about.
Yes, yes. And the person that they're looking for, of course, you know, there's intrigue involved there, but he's described as a Harvard Law School graduate student. He is sort of an unusual background to be someone involved in home invasions and kidnapping, you would think. Yeah. I don't know. So there's more is going to come out of this story. I think we bring you crime stories here at Satellite Sisters that we just don't know what to make of. We don't know who to believe. Do we believe the Vallejo police? Are the FBI onto something? I feel very badly for, you know, Denise and Aaron if this actually happened. But what if it didn't happen, Leanne?
I feel bad that you'd be compared to Gone Girl because that was such an implausible plot. It was just so ridiculous.
Well, this has that same sort of characteristics.
Implausible.
$8,500 for a ransom? Really? I mean,
you're right.
Which at least round it up to 10,000.
10, yeah. Yeah. You go for
or
10.
At least 9,000. Okay, you can. You know, I mean, I understand. You might. Well, I don't know, Lynn. And she ended up in her home, back in a hometown of Huntington Beach. It's just all very strange and puzzling.
But you're going to be busy following El Chapo and Gone Girl.
I know, Lynn. Okay.
Stay on it and watching the kids. All right. Speaking of that, I know we have to get to Poldark and Handsome. We're going to take a quick break. And then when we return, episode 4, very, very satisfying. We're the Satellite Sisters. Stay with us. We're back. You're listening to the Satellite Sisters. I'm Leanne Dolan here with my sister Julie Dolan, and it is time for our weekly recap of PBS's Poldark on Masterpiece Poldark and Handsome. Julie, this episode was top-notch, wasn't it?
Leanne, I have in capital letters in my notes, satisfying episode. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
It is one that you're going to want to watch again and savor. Yeah.
Okay, let's just review quickly. Okay, this episode had horrendous medical care in it. It had Pygmalion week at the cottage. Mm-hmm. It had holiday entertaining and funeral etiquette.
Yes.
It had a wifey talent show. And it had just a lot of people staring out into the sea, didn't it?
Yes. In fact, I was surprised because I was surprised that the nautical aspect of this show. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And then it had, you know, for you lads out there that have been manscaping, if you've been waxing your chest, I just want to turn your attention to episode 4 of Poldark, because I believe the overhead shots of Ross Poldark in bed with his chest hair will convince you to stop waxing your chest. Yes. Don't you think, Julie?
So right here and right now, Leanne.
Yeah.
Never again.
I'm telling you, boys, just take a look and then rethink the waxing. That's all I want to say. All right, Julie, let's start from the very beginning. A lot of the show overall was it was just the response both by the public, the town, the business associates, and also by Demelza and Ross about, like, why did he marry Demelza? Demelza right. was asking the question. There was clear there were times when Ross was asking the question. Mm-hmm. She was getting used to her new role. The family was getting used to the role. The town was getting used to the new role. And in the beginning of the show, we had a back and forth. And we hear people's reactions to the wedding. And poor Demelza was called everything from a scullery maid to a serving wench to a kitchen maid to a mistress almighty to a slut. Like, poor Demelza.
I know, but Leanne, she got more beautiful in every single scene that she's in. So not so poor for Demelza. I think she knew that she had this inner power. But I have to start off at the beginning, Leanne, with the breakout performances of Mr. and Mrs. Drunk. Okay. That's what you have named them. Yes. They had their heads up off the table
yeah.
and were delivering lines, again, about Demelza and why she should not be Ross's wife. But it started strong with their breakout performances.
Good point, Julie. Excellent point. All right. So we've moved from this scene. We do get it's clear that Ross is quite smitten with her, at least when it comes to going to bed.
Yes, indeed, Leanne. A best line for me for Ross is when he turns to Demelza and says, "Suppose I have other plans for you." I would enjoy any planning exercise with Ross Poldark, Leanne. I'm pretty sure about that.
That's right. She is like slamming the bread to the table, but he's got other plans for Demelza.
And planning exercises with Ross Poldark. Put it on your schedule for the week.
In the meantime, out in the real world, things are going south with the mine. Ross trying to revive the mine of his father. They're looking for copper. All they're getting is iron. They're running out of money. Public support is turning away in terms of funding, is turning away from Ross because of his controversial marriage to the scullery maid. And so that's looking bad. And then the women of the town spend most of the episode staring out at the sea.
You know, Leanne, when they were staring at the beginning, I was like, what are they looking at? What are they waiting for? And again, with those accents, I couldn't really make out what they expected to arrive. Was it pirate ships? I didn't know what, Leanne.
It was pilchers, Julie. It was pilchers. And if you're wondering what that was, as I was, and you Googled it, first of all, Rosamund Pilcher came up, and she's a lovely actress. Speaking of Gone Girl. But that's not who they were waiting for. Pilchers are another word for sardines. Mm-hmm. And apparently in Cornwall, Julie, it was a major industry from 1750 to 1880 was the catching and canning of sardines. I did some research.
Thank you, Leanne. Can I say in that scene when I hope I'm not giving it away for everybody, the boats do come in with the sardines.
Yeah.
The fishmongering scene where they're just hurling and throwing smelly sardines off the boat. And again, they're all just so happy. They're
so
enjoying
happy.
Them. They look as happy as the miners, Leanne. I mean, these are the two worst jobs, mining and fishmongering. But everyone in Cornwall seems to really enjoy it.
And it's a bonding experience for Ross and for Demelza, but also for Demelza and Ross and the rest of the town. After she's getting in there and getting the fish, and Ross couldn't be happier, there's a lot of people saying, thank you, ma'am, calling her, you know, by the new honorific that she has been given thanks to being Ross's wife now, as opposed to the kitchen maid. So, so the peasants are happy, even though there's no copper yet in the mine. There are sardines, and that makes them very happy. Okay. In the meantime, the real family, Ross's rest of the Poldark family, not so happy. They're quite astonished by the fact that he has married the kitchen maid. There is no joy in Mudville over there. That first of all, being part of that family looks terrible, doesn't it, Julie?
Worse than the Windsors, Leanne. I mean, Verity is the only true shining light. I have to say, though, Elizabeth, I do like Elizabeth.
Yes.
You know, she's you know, she has many fine qualities. I understand why Ross likes her so much. So, but yeah, that's a deadly family over there.
Just looks like a terrible thing to be highborn and in this terrible family.
Yeah.
You know, certainly Francis, the cousin of Ross. We established last week he's a loser. And over the course of the episode, he just becomes a nasty loser. The uncle, after a good long session of bloodletting, which is, I'm glad that medical practice has gone by the wayside.
That would not be good for you, Liam. No.
I couldn't even watch the scene. I mean, it does make you think, like, that was not that long ago. That was only 200 years ago that they thought draining sick people of their blood was a good idea. How stupid is that?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
What does the uncle do right after a nice session of bloodletting? He tries to jump up on his horse, right?
I mean, he was never getting on that horse, Julie. Do you agree?
Yeah, the horse was way too high.
The horse was a gigantic horse.
I was just
horse.
Looking at where the stirrups were, where his legs were. It was not going to happen. But he's done. He said, now this is his second like dying scene, Leon, where he's collapsed as part of the show. So that seems to be what he's doing. You know, the Mr. and Mrs. Drunk are going to keep their heads down on the table, and the uncle is going to continue to collapse in every episode.
And he calls Ross to him and he says in this dying scene, and I didn't think he was actually going to die, but he said, Ross, basically my son is a loser and Francis is a loser. You have to look out for our family name. And then he up and dies, doesn't he? Couldn't believe it.
Well, I kind of could. Okay. He hadn't been well, Liam. Yeah. Not one bit.
That's He was apoplectic. And then he died. So it looks like this could either be good or bad for Ross and DeMille. So it could be a fresh start for the Poldark family. Maybe Francis, now that his berating father is gone, can finally make peace with, you know, his legacy and can get his act together and stop being such a loser and going to prostitutes. And to work that all out, he does what everyone in Cornwall does. He stares out at the sea, right? So the women are still staring. The loser cousin is still staring out at the sea. But in the meantime, Verity's got to get out of there. And she heads over to DeMelza's cottage. And after one very tense scene where they're, what is that called? Stitching? What were they doing?
I'm not even going to answer that, Liam. What is that called? Stitching?
It just looks so boring to be a woman then to sit in.
Many people find that just highly satisfying, enjoying. It's enjoyable. It's a work of art, Leon. It can be very calming and relaxing. Perhaps you should take up cross stitch, Leon, or embroidery.
Okay. I don't think so. But Verity just puts it out there that she doesn't care who Ross is married, except that, you know, he clearly likes her, and we have to hear from DeMelza. Oh, he may like me, but he doesn't love me and he'll never love me. We don't have that kind of relationship. And then Pygmalion camp starts. I mean, that's fun. Verity goes to town making a lady out of DeMelza. So there's dancing and there's napkin folding and then there's shopping. It's excellent.
Way to go. Yes. I mean, everybody needs a friend like Verity. I mean, she has that unfortunate nose, but she is a delightful person.
And she does confide in DeMelza, you know, that she's lost the love of her life and, you know, it's terrible to live without love and that she's a lucky person. It's a very touching scene and it's nice to see the two of them bond. So when there's this turnaround at Christmas time, Francis invites Ross and DeMelza to the house for Christmas Eve.
Oof, I was like, don't go. Holidays with the relatives. You know that's a bad idea, Liam. I know it.
The only thing that's exciting is that we see that DeMelza has a new dress that's arrived. So we know that's going to be a big plot point. And that's exciting. But Christmas Eve, it's just supposed to be, you know, the five of them. And then the world's worst house guests show up. I mean, first of all, who arrives unannounced on Christmas Eve?
Yeah.
What kind of peasant does that? And it turns out it's the evil banker George. And I think was that his wife who was doing all the mouthing off?
Yes. So she's just awful. And she works hard at being awful too. And she has just honed in on DeMelza and she just starts picking at DeMelza, you know, throughout the evening, Leon.
But DeMelza walks in that red dress and jaws drop. Not the least of which, I mean, I thought Ross was just going to expose his chest hair right there. I thought he was just going to
that the linen shirt was going to just fall off or, yes. or burst into flames. One of the two, Leanne. Yes. I'm not sure. No, it was a triumphant moment for Demelza. And again, Verity was very nice. And this is what all good friends should do, is just don't lace your friends up too tightly in the dress, right?
Right.
I hope I could count on you, Leanne, if I had to be laced up, that you wouldn't do it too tightly.
I would not do it too tightly, Julie. I might be surprised if you were with child at this point.
Okay. Okay, smarty pants. Okay. All right. But yes, she did look magnificent. She had just a subtle, lovely little necklace on. She looked like she belonged at that table, Leanne.
Yes.
She looked better than anyone. She really looked better than Elizabeth, you know.
And with her charming answers and her plain speech, she managed to charm everyone at the table except George's yes. evil wife, who kept picking away and picking away at her. But she handled everything beautifully. And then after dinner, she had to go throw up because we know that she is with child. She hasn't told Ross yet. She's only told Verity. She looks terrible. She has to come downstairs and immediately be part of that horrific, you know, British tradition of like musicales after dinner. I mean, what is that?
I mean, what would you pick, Leanne? A harp, the piano? It's, yeah. it's all tough, you know?
Competitive cross stitching. I don't know. And the people, it's just, you know, some amusement after dinner. So we, of course, Elizabeth's playing the harp and it's beautiful. And then we have to hear a song from Demelza. And she kills it, man. She lays it down like Adele. She sings this heartbreaking song about having her heart plucked by love or her finger pricked. I don't know what the lyrics of that song were, Julie, but everyone in the room falls in love with her, right?
Yes. I mean, Leanne, you and I must learn to sing. That's what I wrote down. Because that was it. That was the tide has turned. They're in that gorgeous red dress, singing that song. Everyone realized that she was truly a beautiful person.
Right. And then, and all ends on really a happy note, actually. As they leave the house, it seems like the family is reunited. Even Francis has sort of redeemed himself. And it's no wonder that Demelza is exhausted, Julie. Ross keeps making her walk all over Cornwall.
Well, I think in her condition, it's better than galloping. Those are her two options of transportation. Yeah, he could get a carriage.
He could get a carriage. I mean, my gosh, the poor thing. All right. So, and they're walking past the mine and the bell starts to ring and there's panic. And wouldn't you know it, Julie, they've struck copper. So we're 1 week away from stopping the pay for all of the happy miners. And their pilcher loving wives. And then they strike copper and everything looks good.
Leanne, coming from the land of wildcatters, there is nothing more thrilling than hearing the bell ring. Having that Jed Clampett moment when you strike pay. So I could appreciate that, Leanne.
Okay. Nice Texas touch there. Thank you, Julie. So then Ross and Demelza go home to celebrate, and she decides that this is the moment to tell him that he's with child. And, well, it slays him, doesn't it? I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, Leanne.
Men,
yeah, that was good.
Want to know how to react to your wife telling you she's pregnant, I just want you to fast forward to the end of that episode, because it's all right there. A lesson in how to react. And then he says, I am your humble servant, and I love you. Oh, it was the best.
I know. So this is episode 4, Save It for a Rainy Day. You're homesick from work. This is the episode to just play over and over and over again.
It is. It might replace Pride and Prejudice as my sort of go-to. I've got nothing to do at 5 in the afternoon. I might just do that. It's a good one.
Okay.
It's a good one. But it makes me wonder, where are we going from here? Everything looks so good. What will our dramatic storylines be? What will go wrong?
Things will go wrong, Leanne. You know that this happiness is fleeting. You know, things are going to happen. The fish won't come in. Yeah. The mine. Something will happen in the mine. And there is more to happen for Demelza and Elizabeth. You know, that's going to be.
I hope Ross' chest hair stays intact, though. I hope there's not a tragic mine accident that forces him to shave his chest hair. I hope that's not the case.
I will keep that thought in my heart, Leanne. Okay.
I am your humble servant, Julie. I am your humble servant. We are your humble servants. We're the Satellite Sisters. If you want to find out more about Satellite Sisters, please visit satellitesisters.com. You can find us on Twitter at Sat Sisters. Same at Instagram at Sat Sisters. And we're on Facebook, both as an official page and a group. And we'd love to have you join in the conversation. Just ask us and we'll approve you, because that's the kind of Satellite Sisters we are. All right, Julie, get back to your campers. And don't forget, call your satellite sister.